I think morality is sentimental. You know, it's about how we feel about what's happened rather than some sort of calculus based on logical principles.
Do you think it's based on how we feel? Like, what exactly do you mean by that?
Sure. Like, for example, a libertarian will say the state infringing on my right to bear arms is immoral, and therefore I am rationally justified in this. But the
damn straight.
Yeah, no, no. I agree with it because I'm an Englishman. But the underlying thing under that is a kind of moral prejudice.
Do you identify as a conservative?
I guess I would call myself a traditionalist rather than a conservative.
I feel like I've gone with libertarian since I was like 14.
Well, I mean, libertarian's an ideological viewpoint.
You're telling me I'm stuck in an ideology if I identify as a libertarian?
Well, it's an ideological position. The problem I have with the ideology, really, is that it gives people a false sense of moral superiority. It's not just in the intent, it's actually in the thing you do and the consequences you bring about as well.
Well, I'm not going to be able to say I'm a libertarian after this podcast. So you've taken that.
There's a definite external place that people regard more highly than the people themselves. We use the terms objective all the time and universal, but like, what does that even mean? Like, what does objective mean? It means from the perspective of the universe. That's such a weird thing to aspire to.
Do you think this has anything to do with the lack of religion right now? It would be the view of kind of the good of humanity, you know? Carl Benjamin, welcome to my podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to finally meet you. I feel like I've heard of you. I've been following you on Twitter forever. My friends have had you on their podcasts. And we haven't spoken before, so this should be fun.
Yeah, I saw your Oxford Union address, actually.
The meat one? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm constantly in a battle against the vegans. Meat's good, and we should eat it.
I think I technically lost that. Like, they do a vote at the end, and I think I lost. But there's a bit of confusion about people, which door you exit to vote. So I think I did lose that, though.
I don't really care what the popular consensus on a subject is.
Really?
I'll decide for myself whether I think it's correct or not.
Oh, you don't come off as that type of person at all.
Oh, really?
No, I'm being sarcastic. You definitely, definitely do.
Good.
So were you always like a more, okay, do you identify as a conservative?
Yeah, I think conservative is, excuse me, a fairly... I mean, it's quite a broad label. It's not very, very deep, but it's good enough. I guess I would call myself a traditionalist rather than a conservative, but they overlap quite significantly, so that's fine.
Okay. What's a traditionalist versus a conservative?
Well, a conservative is someone who is always chasing the last paradigm, whereas a traditionalist is someone who is constantly moving forward in their own paradigm. In the paradigm that we've inherited from the past, living in the present, and then inevitably move forward into the future. And I guess you could juxtapose this against any kind of ideologist who has an abstract, a priori view of what the world should look like, and they're constantly trying to interpose that onto reality and reformat reality to make that fit this predefined vision.
Okay. That seems to make sense. I feel like I've gone with libertarian since I was like 14, even though I probably only have a vague understanding of what a libertarian is, but I didn't identify as a conservative. It's like, I don't think I'm that. I don't really like anybody. Whatever viewpoint, not agreeing with anyone, you know, unless I think it's right is. Yeah. Although I suppose everybody thinks that way.
Well, I mean, libertarian's an ideological viewpoint. So you've got a sort of
predefined... You're telling me I'm stuck in an ideology if I identify as a libertarian? Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying this episode. I certainly did. Just dropping in to suggest a sauna blanket as an excellent Christmas gift for your loved ones or yourself. Bond Charger's infrared sauna blanket is my go-to portable sauna blanket. Again, we're exposed to so many toxins daily. I don't think people take that as seriously as they should. I wish this was touched on more because I think it's what's behind my autoimmunity and food sensitivities and my parents' illnesses, environmental exposures, and saunas are one of the things you can do to help your body detox faster, among other things. These sauna blankets work just like a big sauna, but they're portable, easy to clean, easy to store. They ship worldwide,
And if it doesn't meet your expectations for some reason, or maybe you're just whiny and you don't want to sweat, their easy return policies has you covered with a 30-day trial and a solid 12-month warranty. You can go to bondcharge.com, that's bondcharge.com/MP, and use code MP to save 15% off. It's linked in the comments, so consider it as a healthy Christmas gift. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, it's an ideological position, isn't it? Like, it's, I mean, a lot of people do have ideologies, and it's not necessarily that ideologies are always bad. I guess the question is really whether you let reality get overridden by the ideology or you override reality with the ideology. And the problem I have with the ideology really is that it gives people a false sense of moral superiority. And they say, well, I adhere to a particular ideology and therefore I am a good person, regardless really of what I've done or what I will do, because I hold a certain set of beliefs. And I just don't really believe that morality works that way. I don't really believe that being a good person works that way. I actually think it's not just in the intent that morality is located. It's actually in the thing you do, and the consequences you bring about as well are all part of the moral scheme. And so you can believe a good thing, do a good thing, and end up with a negative consequence, and you might not be a bad person in the immediate sense, but if you keep doing that thing and you know you're going to get the negative consequence, then it becomes a kind of form of vanity where you're like, well, I'm just doing it for me now, even though I'm bringing about all these negative consequences. And then conversely, if you had a person who was like an incompetent supervillain and they're like, right, I'm going to kill everyone in this city, and actually they tried to poison the well and it gave everyone really clean teeth or something, you know, like, you wouldn't say, oh, that's a good person because they helped everyone. No, they were trying to hurt them, you know. So I think the morality is in all of these spaces. It's not just in one place. So this really is the problem I have with ideology. And also, it doesn't really track to reality. Because, I mean, there's a genuine question at the moment of whether we want free markets or whether we want property ownership. Like, free markets are an ideological abstraction, but property ownership is something real and concrete. But at the moment, free markets are actually inhibiting property ownership because of the free movement of peoples. And so in Britain, for example, we get 1 million new people in a year. You can imagine what that's done to the house prices in this country. And so actually getting on the property ladder is becoming just utterly impossible for regular young people. And so free markets are actually damaging people's ability to own property. And yet this is the ideological abstraction we find ourselves committed to. And I actually want to question those things. And not being ideological means that I can. And I also still have a kind of framework of where I want to be from where I already am, considering where we've just been, you know?
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. I think I had an issue until recently, and I don't know if I've gotten more disagreeable as I got older or just less naive from being screwed over by people and just learning what they're like. But yeah. I'd always track back and go, oh, this person did this bad thing, but look at how they were thinking that brought them up to that moment. Like, that doesn't make them a bad person. They just made a mistake. But then you get these people and they'll just make mistakes and hurt more and more and more people. And I suppose then you end up in, like, you know, worst case scenario, that's a Hitler position, as he thought he was doing stuff. He thought he was doing something good, and he most certainly wasn't. So, like, you were talking about intent behind actions, not, you know, being a marker for morality, which I think is completely accurate. Doesn't really matter how you got where you are, but if you're doing something bad, then that should speak for itself. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. And like, when you take this kind of more three-dimensional view of what morality is, you realize just how shallow the modern discourse is, right? Like, we're libertarians, we're socialists, and they're constantly arguing from these very abstract positions where they ascribe to themselves all perfect goodness and light. And so obviously anyone who disagrees with that must be a bad person or really stupid. And actually it could just be that maybe they don't describe all of what morality is, and things are really complex, and really we need to get out of the abstract spaces and get into the real world and actually look at what's going on. And I don't think morality is rational. That's the thing, because the problem with the ideology is entirely rational. I think morality is sentimental. You know, it's about how we feel about what's happened, really, rather than some sort of calculus based on logical principles. I don't really think morality works that way.
You think it's based on how we feel?
Yeah.
Okay, can you
sentiment. So
okay, can you do yeah, describe that a little bit? So if you care about something happen, like what exactly do you mean by that?
For example, a libertarian will say, okay, the state infringing on my right to bear arms is immoral, and therefore I am rationally justified in this, or I have a particular rational justification for how I believe. But the underlying I agree with that, right? Because I'm an Englishman. But the underlying thing under that really is a kind of just moral prejudice. So I feel that that's correct. And the people who want to take away weapons are those people who feel that really, and they'll come up with a rational justification, but underneath that is really just a kind of personal prejudice against you being able to defend yourself because they believe something crazy. As you can see, I'm a lot more sympathetic to the libertarian side of any argument than I am the socialist side. But really, it's how to describe it, like kind of strings, I guess, that connect each other together. And morality is kind of found in that connection between two people. And that's a sentimental bond. So like when you get people who are like, say, oh, I'm abstractly sort of, Jesse Lee Peterson has this question. He's like, do you love black people? He's like, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean? Black people as a class, you know, some sort of abstract gestalt entity, you know, like, what does that mean? I don't love white people. I don't love black people. But I do love this person and I do love that person. I love this place that I've been to, you know, like it's not a rational construct. It's a heartfelt emotion that you feel in your chest that I think is the real root of morality. And that's what we struggle with every day. And I think that the modern way of describing the world has become entirely rationalistic. Because what I love doing, right, is reading books from like 100 years ago, because they just talk in a different way to the way we talk now. And they talk about things in a much more rich and in many ways sort of judgmental way. But you can tell they really love the things that they're talking about. Whereas we seem a lot more shallow and a lot more disconnected from things. And I'm not even sure I've got the proper language to describe what I'm trying to put across here, you know? But there's definitely something hollow about the lives we're leading now compared to the way people experience the world in the pre-20th century era.
I wonder if it's too much. Yes, I agree. And you can definitely pick that up in older books. Yeah. Do you think that's just from, like, how much of that is from overstimulation from just being exposed to so many things at the same time? Doesn't that make you care less almost?
Maybe.
There's just so much going on.
I think there was always quite a lot going on in the past, though. And often it was way worse than what's going on now. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, we were losing 50,000 men a day in trenches, you know, and the entire nations were heaving at war with one another across the world for 5 years at a time. So I don't know if it's that things are, there's less or more going on necessarily. We're definitely more immediately stimulated. But I can't ever feel this is a consequence of what's happened rather than the source of the problem. There seems to me something wrong with the way we use science. And I'm not the only person to have thought this. Like C.S. Lewis and Julius Savola both came to the same conclusion, whereas like science, the locus of science is outside of humanity, and so science is being done for its own sake rather than for the sake of mankind. And actually, I think that we should put ourselves as the primary good here when we're doing science. And when science is outside of us as the primary good, it's, I mean, for example, social media. Who was the co-founder of social media, Facebook, who was like, look, we knew this was addictive and we did it anyway. Well, then you're not doing that for the good of the people using it. Because, I mean, social media sounds like a great idea. Hey, you can easily contact your friends. Okay,
yeah.
We need to do it for our own good, not for the good of the platform getting clicks to make money for advertisers and things like that. That's an external goal to the goal of actually making something good for us to use in the world. And a lot of science is like this. And so I'm not trying to just throw science entirely under the bus or something, but like there's a definite external place that people regard more highly than the people themselves. And I'm really concerned about that. Like we use the terms objective all the time. and universal, but like, what does that even mean? Like, what does objective mean? It means from the perspective of the universe, like a perspective of non-mankind, like the universe as a giant entire conceptual entity looks at something and is supposed to make a judgment. It's like, that's such a weird thing to aspire to. Like, can't we just use human judgments? We are humans, you know? It should be okay for us to make our human judgments from the perspective of our own two eyes looking at something as human beings. So I know I'm going on, but like, this has really got me on a tangent. But I just, there's something wrong with the way we're conceiving of the world and we're trying to put it right. There's something wrong with it.
Do you think that this could just be kind of, this could be, okay, so how do I describe this without sounding like a moron? Do you think this has anything to do with a lack of religion right now? Or lack of kind of Judeo-Christian beliefs as a foundation of society? Because that would put you outside of, not science, like that's not exactly what I mean, yeah. But it would be the view of kind of the good of humanity, you know, yeah. as opposed to looking at things through this objective scientific lens.
So I've wondered this because I wonder, so if you go back 200 years, that in philosophical circles, they're questioning, or no, in 300 years, they're questioning whether the idea of a mechanical universe, a self-sustaining universe that doesn't require God to be a part of the universe and a sort of prime mover in the universe, will eventually destroy faith in God. And this was proposed by John Locke, and it was refuted by a chap called Berkeley. He said, no, look, you're going to create a world full of atheists if they don't believe God is the underpinning force of the universe. And John Locke, who himself was obviously a deeply religious man and wanted atheism outlawed, essentially just denied this. He said, no, that's not going to happen. Well, actually, he was wrong. That has happened. Like, if you look around, especially in my country, almost everyone is either some version of agnostic atheist or nominally Christian, but never goes to church. The church attendance here is like 6%. It's really yeah. low. So in our sort of revealed religion, we're atheists. And so I don't know whether, you know, it's a consequence of that. But I wouldn't be surprised if that turned out to be the case. It would not surprise me. And the thing is, I've struggled with this. I've got Christian friends. I'm like, look, you could just become a Christian. I'm like, no, I could
also kind of hard.
Christian.
Yeah. Right. You can't just like suddenly become one.
Exactly. I was raised in what is essentially a sort of irreligious society. And so I've been trying to explain to them, look, I actually feel like maybe it's a kind of disability or something. I just don't have the thing required to do the thing that you're asking me to do. But I don't know. I don't know.
I had a pretty big shift. So 2 years ago, I grew up in a totally like either atheist or agnostic society too in Toronto. I didn't know anyone. I knew one person whose family went to church, and then he was always complaining, oh, I have to go to church. And then he stopped going to church. And that was the only, and I was like, oh, the weirdos that go to church. That was like, and then I had my dad and he told me, oh, there's like importance in these stories. But I mean, it's hard to understand that when you're like 10. And then a couple of years I just had too many weird miraculous experiences where I finally like clicked in. And so now I believe in God, which is something that I had always been like, maybe, I don't know what's out there. Like maybe it's a thing, but I never got it. And my mom converted to Catholicism and I was like, that seems to be working for you, but I don't get it. I don't feel it. And I feel like from meeting Christians, specific Christians, the way they look at the world is definitely significantly different than how I grew up. Like I grew up looking at it through a scientific objective lens and it was pretty depressing, I would say. It's kind of harsh, but it's not something you can just click on, oh, believe this.
Yeah.
Like how are you supposed to believe that?
No, I'm totally with you. Like for me, I never felt like I lacked religion. There was nothing, there was no like hole there for me. I was just being a happy, normal person. My whole life, you know, I've always been pretty optimistic. But I've never not believed in a sort of mechanical universe because it seems to be true to me. I But there are definitely unanswered questions. And but the point I think you're making is totally true. Whatever it is I'm supposed to feel, I just don't, and I don't want to be an authentic about that. But conversely, mm-hmm. I am very sympathetic to the Christians. I mean, there are, you know, every Christian I've ever met has been a lovely person, right? Really good, really decent.
That's always weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I look back at the new atheists. I think, why are you attacking these people? You know, like, aren't there worse people on earth to attack than these people? And then, you know, Christianity is the tradition of the West, right? It's definitely the moral bedrock upon which our societies are based. And again, this is another place where the new atheists were just wrong, really. You know, the Enlightenment, the secular rational world, wasn't something independent of Christianity. It was made by Christians. And so I don't see why we would deny that, as it's so self-evidently true, if you just know anything about the history of the evolution of our philosophies. So that's another thing. Okay, well, you know, why can't we give Christianity its just due here in improving the world? And there's nothing repugnant about Christian doctrine to me either, right? You know, I don't want to be like, well, Jesus was a great moral teacher. I mean, obviously, that's not really, you know, it's an asinine thing to say. But there's nothing repugnant about the religion. So I don't feel the need to attack it. I can think of far more repugnant religions to attack if I felt inclined. So I don't understand why we aren't more sympathetic to the Christians. But the Christians are the ones who just get ignored, if not persecuted. I mean, in my country, they're actively being persecuted by the state. For example, if you're a Christian woman and you go and pray silently in your own head outside an abortion clinic, you get arrested for having a thought crime. So it's, and if you're a Christian street preacher, you get arrested for spreading hate speech. So,
oh
yeah, that doesn't happen to the Islamic preachers. So it's just remarkable.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's weird. So if you have two people that are, I remember there was this guy in downtown Toronto that used to walk downtown, and every time you passed him, he'd yell Jesus. And so you'd pass him and he's like, oh, like this guy yelling Jesus at you. So those people, if they're of like Islam faith in the UK, that's okay. But it's not okay if they're Christians. I haven't heard this.
I've never seen an example of an Islamic preacher on the street being
okay,
having any kind of negative contact with the police. But I've seen it multiple times where a Christian preacher, and often they'll be from Africa, so it's not even, you know, they're not even native people, but they'll still be arrested because it's Christian doctrine that they're promoting. And it's just very strange. Like, why would the British state operate in such a way?
Yeah, that's weird. So how has, in the last 5 years, how have you seen, like, where in the UK are you, approximately?
I'm in the Southwest.
Okay, and have you seen that area change in the last 5 years?
Yeah, it's been tragic. So in Britain, we're a very small country with a very high population density, particularly in England. And we, for some reason, for the last 13 years, have had a conservative government that has just allowed increasing numbers of people from anywhere in the world to come and live here. And that has noticeably damaged not only the fabric of society, but the institutions of society. And it's driving the country off of a cliff, because a lot of our infrastructure was built 50 years ago for a population of about 45 to 50 million. And we now have, official figures put it at 69 million. But the thing is, there are going to be millions of illegals also here. So it's probably somewhere north of 70, up to about 75. In 2011, one of the supermarkets came out and said, we're selling enough food for 80 million people. And everyone said, that can't be right. But it might not be so terribly wrong. Because, I mean, you know, they are feeding people,
wow,
so they should know. But the thing that's done is made everything worse. It's just the sheer number of people. So the roads are always packed. The roads are in terrible condition. Everything costs way more than it ought. Healthcare is a black hole. So every year, I mean, and it's just mathematically inevitable. If every year you bring in a million people and say 1% of those didn't need to use the healthcare system, which is going to be way more than that, but let's get charitably 1%. Well, that's 1% that's not being paid for. So that's an extra however many percentage out of the budget for the National Health Service that has to come on the shoulders of the people already here. And then you think, okay, well, they'll get jobs. Well, let's assume they all got jobs. Next year, you've got another 1 million people, a percentage of those. And so it's inevitable that the costs will continue to spiral. And this is just destroying the NHS. Like, it's terrible for the doctors and the nurses because they're run ragged. The NHS has got like a horrific staff turnover rate where obviously people don't want to work there as a doctor or a nurse. They move abroad. They go somewhere else where they'll actually be paid half decently and they won't be run ragged all the time. But then you've got like so many other things, just like jobs. It's about rent or housing or social services. It's about literally, and then you look at the actual state of the cities, because no one's taking care of where they live, because the social fabric is kind of constantly under attack by the addition of new people. Everyone just lets everything fall into disrepair, and so you walk through the high streets, and then you can see the quality of the buildings. It's just they're falling apart because they're not being upkept. And then you look at the actual high streets themselves, and they're all boarded up, just boarded up shops. And often what they'll do is they'll wallpaper on a picture of an active shop. So it's like, yeah, this used to be a high street.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, because and that's not the fault of necessarily immigration or anything like that. But then you get lots of foreign shops springing up in the town centres where the immigrants live. And so where I live, this has happened in the last 3 years, 4 years. Like, just before the COVID pandemic, this was a relatively normal English town. Immigration keeps going, and now something like a quarter of the town is foreign born, and it's really noticeable in the town center. And I work in the town center, so I'm going, and like, it's just every day, it's like being in the bazaar of Baghdad. Like, it's not any, if it was a people from somewhere, you know, you could at least be like, right, okay, that's predictable, you know, I can get to know the culture, I could possibly learn some of the language, I could learn the habits, I could make some friends in that culture. But it's not like that, because these people are from literally everywhere in the world and they don't know each other. They don't share a common culture or a common heritage or a common language or a common religion. And so it's just people, like this sort of nomad mass of humanity that's just wandering around a small, well, it's not small actually, it's quite a large town in Wiltshire. And it's just like, what are you doing here? You know, you can't possibly have known when you were living 50,000 miles away that my town even existed before you arrived. I don't believe you knew that this place existed before you got to the UK. How did you arrive here? You know, but anyway, so yeah, things are degrading and people feel alienated. I actually walked past a friend of mine. Then this is another thing that really bothers me, is that I've lived in this town for 25 years and my family is from one of the sort of suburbs of this town. And I have had loads of friends here. And whenever I walk through the town centre, I'd you know, bump into two or three people I met. Even though there's like 250,000 people in the area of Swindon where I live. But it had a kind of small town vibe because it wasn't a city. And so everyone kind of knew everyone else. So you'd recognize them from hanging out with someone else, whatever. And so I'd walk through the town, I'd bump into friends and family and stuff. But that just never happens anymore. And I bumped into an old friend of mine. And we were just standing in the middle of the shopping center in the town, surrounded by just people from all over the world. And he's like, mate, I feel like a stranger in my own land. He's been here his whole life, and he feels totally alienated from the town he's been born and raised in. That's how quickly this has happened. And this is what's happened to these people and to me. And it's just, it's not fair. You know, it's not fair to do this to these people.
That's wild. I feel like Toronto was always kind of a melting pot of people.
Sure.
But they were all kind of Canadian, yeah. Right? So they like they'd immigrate, but they were all Canadian. Like it was a melting pot, but it was nice. And I left Canada a couple of years ago when the COVID didn't stop there, when they shut down everything and like wrecked downtown. I was like, okay, this is heading in a bad direction. I'm going to go to America. That seems to be there's America crazy, but there's at least pockets in America that aren't crazy. And in Canada, I couldn't find that anymore. It boggles my mind that government officials didn't see any issues, you know, Like they must have at least foreseen the healthcare system having issues. You'd think if you had that job, you'd be like, hey, this seems like immigration is great. Let's get these people in.
Yeah.
But let's definitely make sure we have healthcare for everyone who still lives there and is going to come. Like, how do you miss that?
Arrogance? It seems important, doesn't it?
A little
bit. It seems
bit.
Important. And pensions as well. Just like one of the reasons that the British government brings in so many foreigners is because they think, well, we need people to pay for pensions. It's like they get old too. Like, you know, they don't stay young forever. They also get old and draw a pension. And so it's a pyramid scheme, effectively, to try and keep the pensions up. But I say that in Canada, at least, I mean, like you say, you know, they felt Canadian, because I guess Canada's had a lot of immigration for a long time, right? Britain's never had immigration. Like 1948, 49, something like that, was the very first time we really had immigration to this country. And even then, it was about 400 or 500 people, like 400 or 500 people. And so for most of the 20th century, Britain was just a British country. It was just the native population of Britain that lived here. And then towards the end, in the 90s, the government's decided we're just going to open up the borders completely. And now a quarter of England is foreign born. And it's just like, okay, but we're not prepared for this. Like, we don't have, like, in America, it's fine because they've got an ideology for it, right? They're like, oh, you've got the American dream. We have Americanism. We can define in like 5 points what it is to be an American. And so you have a very clear set of instructions on what you're supposed to do as an immigrant to America to fit in with Americans. We don't have anything like that. We're nothing like that. We're an old world country. We're an ancient country. We're 1,000 years old. You know, we're not prepared for this. And so it's just like they're and so basically you get what in America you call white flight. We don't really call it that over here, but that's what's happening. But it's happening really fast, and it's allowing the cities of England to become non-English. So like London is 37% English, Luton's 33%, I think Leicester's about 34%, Birmingham's sort of like 40-45% English. And this just changes the character of these places. It's not that the people in them are bad or anything like that. They're not bad people, you know, thank God. Otherwise, it'd be, you know, pandemonium. But it's something that nobody asked for. You know, there was never a vote in this country. Shall we have millions of people come and live here? This is just something the politicians have been doing to us for 25 years, and no one knows why. And for some reason, they won't make it stop. I mean, the Home Secretary at the moment was a woman called Swella Braverman, who's an Indian woman, who was like, we need to stop immigration. This is crazy. We're destroying our country for some reason. She herself is an immigrant, but it's not an irrational thing to say. She's completely correct. And I know loads of people who are themselves immigrants who are like, yeah, you can't just let the whole world in or else you're going to ruin everything. And she got fired by the Conservative Prime Minister, who is also an Indian, but not because it was like racist or something. It was because the press just start flapping their gums and, oh no, there's a furore in the press now. It's like, but what? She's right. Everyone knows she's right. You know, and she's currently getting a huge amount of support for being right because she's like the only person in the government who's prepared to tell the truth. And it's just this weird, unmentionable thing. But like, we're not a new country. We're not a new world country. We're not a social contract country. You know, we're a country that is based on ancient traditions, based on an ancient population. I mean, there are people in Britain. There was in Cheddar Gorge, right? They found the skeleton of a man that dated back about 9,000 years to the Ice Age. And so they started DNA testing people in the local area. And 2 miles away, they found his direct descendant. He was a history teacher.
Uh-huh.
2 miles away, 9,000 years of time, his descendants living there. And so that should tell you how ancient this place is. And so it's just bizarre to me that we're prepared to just treat it like it's some sort of undiscovered land. You know, the government's prepared to just act as if this is a new frontier. Oh, we need to bring as many people as we can. That's not the case. Sorry, I know I'm going on, but it's the primary issue in my country.
Yeah, and I'd forgotten about that. That's all, like, it's obvious once you say it. But because Britain is compared to, like, the U.S. or Canada in terms of immigration, and it's true. Canada's really new. And everybody there was immigrants, like all my grandparents weren't born. My great grandparents, anyway, weren't born in Canada. And then it's the same with the U.S. I like attract back relatives to something like the 1600s. So like early, but that was the beginning, right? It wasn't It wasn't older than that. Yeah, that does. And so then we have had hundreds of years to kind of figure out how to include immigrants because everybody was an immigrant to begin with. That's definitely different than Britain.
And your countries are also massive.
Yes, very.
England is actually really tiny. It's actually a really small and really densely. It's something like the fifth most densely populated place on the earth. You know, it's really small from a land scale. I mean, genuinely, like, pull up a map and put, like, you'll probably be able to find a map that someone's interposed England into. Like, it's probably smaller than New England. You know, it's really actually very small. And it's also very old. And so, but we're being treated like we're the American frontier by our own governments. And it's just ruining everything that we've got. And again, it's not the immigrants are bad people or anything like that. And it's not that we can never have any immigrants or that none of them should live here. It's just, we take a million a year. That's mad. Yeah.
That for that amount of space, that's mad.
It's yeah. So anyway, that's the problem with England at the moment. It's falling apart.
So do you think, okay, so two questions. I feel like the same kind of thing happened in Paris, right?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't Paris have massive immigration and then Paris started to not look like Paris?
Yep.
So that, I went there a couple of years ago and I was like, oh, this is really multicultural. This is more, I was expecting French people.
Yeah, not, it's the same in a lot of parts of London. In central London, there are still a lot of English people because it's where the fancy stuff happens. But you are, I went through Paris a few years ago and it was just, I could have been in the Middle East, you know.
Do you think you're doomed as a country, or do you think things are going to reach a point where everybody recognizes there's an issue and things are going to turn around?
To be honest with you, everyone recognizes that there's an issue already.
So you're already at that point.
Oh yeah. Consistently, the British public has been 60% plus against immigration. Not like, you know, like, you know, maybe, no, we want less immigration. And that's been for decades. For some reason, the politicians just don't care. And for some reason, the British public only vote for left or right, the blue or red. For some reason, they won't vote for a third alternative that will actually do something about it. So, I mean, doomed is a strong word that I probably wouldn't use because we're a very old country. Things have been worse, right? There was a time in our history when the Vikings owned there used to be seven kingdoms in England. The Vikings conquered all but one, and that one kingdom went on to reconquer all of England.
That
was Alfred the Great. So it's been worse. It's been way worse. But it's not looking good. And the problem is not that things are unsalvageable. The problem is we're on a set of rails and there's no light at the end of the tunnel, and we are just going to keep going down these rails. So things about now, in 50 years' time, they're going to be way worse. Then 50 years after that, it doesn't really bear thinking about.
Yeah.
So but did we the could Vikings, change this at any time.
Did the Vikings stick around? Like, is there a subset of the population that are Vikings, or did they get kicked out or killed, I guess?
Both, all three, actually. So initially, Alfred reconquered about half of England, and his grandson went on to conquer the rest, which kicked out all the Viking rulers. But there were still populations of Danes living here. And then a chap called Ethelred the Unready conducted a kind of Rwanda-style massacre of Danes in England.
Oh.
This was in about the 900s, you know, so this is the sort of thing people did in the 900s. I mean, and don't feel bad for the Vikings, right? They had come over as genocidal rapists and pillagers, right?
Okay.
You know, they settled the area by killing the people in the area. Don't feel bad for these guys. they did this all over Europe and in the Mediterranean and in Russia, and, you know, they weren't good guys. Don't feel bad for them. But this then backfired, and a lot of history happens. But basically, I can't remember what the proportion is, but it's probably like 10 or 15% of, if you were to DNA sequence the English, you'd find it was Danish genes. And then about half Celtic and about third Anglo-Saxon, or 40% Anglo-Saxon. So the English are very much a sort of mongrel race, you know. And the Danes definitely did contribute to it. But that took 1,000 years. You know, it's a very long, long time. And we kind of made it happen. You know, we had kings who were going to do it by the sword. We don't have a government who's prepared to do anything like that these days, and probably for the better.
Probably.
Probably.
Yeah, I feel like there's so many wars recently that you think when you're growing up, oh, this is stuff that happened back in the, you know, hundreds of years ago. This doesn't happen anymore. Yeah. And I feel like there's more and more events happening now that, like, oh, people are still people. Like, we have these rules in society, and you're like, well, our society is more advanced. It doesn't do things like this anymore. Yeah. And that seems to not be true at all.
Yeah, this is liberalism telling us fairy tales, I would say. Liberalism is kind of like a magical spell. It kind of casts itself over your mind. And I was a liberal for many years, like consciously a liberal. And then I just started reading through all of the sort of canonical texts of liberalism and comparing them to what had happened and to other philosophies. And I realized that it's just really well-meaning, but it's wrong. It begins with the idea of a kind of universal human, a sort of proto, you know, universal person who's running around on his own in the woods. And one day he bumps into another person and they don't really care about each other because they're just getting pine cones and acorns and stuff, fruit from the woods. But one day, for some reason, they decide, hey, should we form a government and a society? And they're like, yeah, that's great. And that never happened. That's just a total fantasy. But that's what liberalism believed. And that's the bedrock of liberalism. And that's what it's actually trying to get us back to. The concept of rights, even in the sort of classical liberal thing, is based on the idea of what can a man do when he's alone in the woods. You know, he can speak, he can own weaponry, he can own property, he can get his own food, he can dispose of his own property if there was a market in his own way. That's what liberalism's trying to get back to, is the idea of the atomized man in the woods. But that's just never been the case. And so, right, liberalism's trying to bring about a kind of fiction. And so it's trying to create these kind of universal men who are just the sum of this very sort of narrow corridor of rights, and saying, right, all humans have these rights. And in a way, yes. But what that does is, when you abstract man away from society, you have to abstract all of the particulars of society from the man. And so, okay, he's got a different religion, he's got a different language, he's got a different culture, he has different interests. You know, all of those things have to be taken away to get the universal man. But they're actually all real things that really exist in the world and actually really inform how people act. And so actually, there was never a universal man. We're not all the same. Actually, we're all different. And we don't really understand those guys either. That's the thing. You really don't understand how those people think. And liberalism makes us arrogant enough to think, well, no, they'll all just become like us. And we're seeing that's not true. We're seeing that's just not the case. And so this is why I stopped being liberal, basically.
Hey, popping in again to remind you guys to try my After Party Hangover Supplement. If you ever drink, I find it reduces 80% of my symptoms or more, possibly more, and makes me feel chill and calm the day after drinking. It's actually crazy. We have a 30-day money-back guarantee, so give it a shot, please, for your brain health. FullerHealth.com, code MP for 15% off. And if you try it, please leave a review. I do read all of them. I don't believe there's a comparable product out there. The vitamin electrolyte mixtures just don't work. So if you've tried some hangover supplements and you're like, they're a scam, I promise this one's not. Give it a shot. You can read about how it works on the website. Again, that's fullerhealth.com, code MP for 15% off. Great stocking stuffers too. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
I feel like I believed that until I was exposed to people more. Yes. I literally thought people were just like me. Until I was, 26, and I started traveling, and I went to Eastern Europe for quite a long time. And wow, are Eastern Europeans different than Westerners? I was blown away at how different the belief system is and how that changes things. And it felt a lot more tribal there. And yeah. Canada is like, what's Canada? It's not really a tribe. It's just a bunch of people. I'm not even sure what Canada is, but wow, are other places tribal?
Well, the thing is, like, what we think of as normal is our tribe. That's the thing. But we've conditioned ourselves to not see it as our tribe. But other places outside of us do see this as our tribe. They see this as our sort of, like, liberalism is kind of like Sharia law for the English-speaking world. Like, we come and we insist on your human rights. We insist on these things. But they are like, okay, well, give me a house if you want, you know. But I don't believe in Anglo-Sharia. Like, I'm going to go home and I'm going to be just as tribal as I was in my own tribe, in the way that you kind of are in your tribe. And, you know, you're imposing this on us, but, like, we don't believe it. In the same way as a bunch of Muslim, you know, jihadists were to impose Sharia on me, I'd be like, okay, but I don't believe it. I just don't want to get my head cut off. Or, you know, then it's like, I don't want to go to jail for violating your human rights or whatever, right? They don't believe it. But I mean, some do, don't get me wrong, but, like, a lot don't. And when you take it to other societies, it's just a total failure. You know, I mean, Iraq would be the primary example. They just don't think like us. We just can't do it. Afghanistan's another great example. Like, oh, we're going to set up a liberal democracy in Afghanistan. It's like, you're mad. You know, yeah. You don't know these people if you think that's going to work. And the second America pulls out, the whole thing, like, implodes in a vacuum. So, you know, it's, we do not understand them. And we're so arrogant as to think that, oh, we've got liberalism. We've got all the answers to everything. So we don't really have any answers to any of these things. And when you were saying about wars, like, that's the thing about liberalism. It believes it can bring us to the end of history. And Francis Fukuyama wrote the book, you know, The End of History. Oh, we've got past wars. Mm-hmm. What we're going to do is now just be individual free agents, you know, the liberal dream, roaming about in the forest. But in society, haven't we figured all this out? It's like, the rest of the world hasn't got the memo, actually. You know, the rest of the world's still, like, old world. So, yeah, that's how I stopped being a liberal, basically.
So do you think a more accurate representation rather than individualism is that, generally speaking, people are tribal and people should understand that?
Individualism is a tribe. That's the thing. And I think that's we fail to see that about ourselves. It's the English-speaking world that's individualist, you know, and we have encouraged, say, the French and the Germans to try and adopt that as well. But the problem is they don't really have the same sorts of cultural institutions that the English-speaking world have. And so when we in the Anglosphere look over at them, you know, what are they doing? They're doing it wrong. Of course they're doing it wrong, because really liberalism is the formalization of just the political traditions of the English-speaking world. You know, everything intermeshes together, like the common law is interwoven with the concepts that build up liberalism, like habeas corpus, like free speech, like personal sovereignty. You know, all of these are like English political concepts that of course got spread around with the British Empire, but also got enviously looked upon by the sort of ideologists in the Enlightenment. And the French specifically, you've got plenty of people like Voltaire, Rousseau, you've got a couple of others, I can't remember the names of them because they're weird French names, but they expressly say, like the guy who coined the term ideology, Antoine Lefebvre or something like that, I think his name is, he expressly cites Thomas Hobbes and John Locke as his inspirations for this. They're consciously looking to the rights of Englishmen, because England was a relatively free and fair place. And this is why every political revolutionary goes to London. They all go to London. Like Marx, Rousseau, the fascists. Like when they're exiled from somewhere, they go to London because that's safe. We're not just going to persecute them because we have a kind of ancient political settlement that kind of works for everyone. And that is what becomes formulated into liberalism. And it works in America, which is the sort of preeminent liberal project, because it was fundamentally like founding Anglo stock, you know, English stock. And so really all you're doing there is you're like telling people, this is what you believe, isn't it? And they go, yeah, that is what we believe. It's like, great, well, we're going to have these rules. It's like, okay, but that's what we were doing anyway. I guess we'll write them down and we'll have a formal constitution. It's like, okay, great. Everyone agrees because you already believe these things. But when you take that somewhere else, like South America, for example, which is of course all Spanish speaking or Portuguese, you get massively corrupt democracies in which no one in the English-speaking world would recognize as free countries. And so it's just like, okay, well, that didn't work. Why didn't that work? Well, because it requires, essentially, and Rousseau, I don't like very much, but he was right on this. it doesn't really matter what the constitution is. It doesn't matter what's written. It has to be inscribed on the hearts of the people. And so what he means is it has to be genuinely felt. It has to be a lived experience, dare I say it, for the people of that country. And you only get that when you're born and raised in an authentic tradition that everyone around you is doing and has been doing for, you know, for generations. And you can't just impose that.
Well, yeah, and I suppose maybe part of the reason we've seen such kickback, at least in Canada, was because they started imposing laws that people didn't agree with, and then there was an uproar, right? Well, you know, we wrote down all these laws everybody agrees with. We haven't had issues so far. Here's a new one we'd like to impose on you guys, yeah. And then, like, chaos and hell ensue. Interesting.
God save the truckers.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. So, okay, I checked out your YouTube, and you're not on YouTube. And so why is it, like, not, I mean, you've got a massive channel on YouTube, but your uploads are elsewhere. YouTube been a problem for you?
Well, they demonetized my channel, and so I thought, well, I won't bother. And so we created a website called lotuseaters.com, but we do have a YouTube channel called The Podcast of the Lotus Eaters. So actually, yeah, we upload lots of stuff there rather than on my channel. Really, I'm kind of doing it out of spite, because I don't, like, we broadcast to the website, so that's, you know, where the labor goes, because people subscribe to the website for $5 a month, and that's how we pay for the bills, you know, because obviously YouTube won't last monetized. And so we do put clips up on YouTube just because, you know, YouTube's a big platform.
Yeah.
Kind of got to use it. But it's not the primary one that we put our effort into. Just because I'm just kind of resentful. Like, I don't think I'm actually terribly politically radical, and YouTube's just like, no, you have to be demonetized. So, okay, fine. You know, fine.
Why did you get so you got permanently demonetized?
Yeah. Because I made a joke about a politician. And it was like, okay.
I'm not allowed
to make jokes about politicians. I mean,
that's a sign of a free society.
It was a very rude joke. I'm not going to say it wasn't, but, like, I mean, politicians used to be fair game, you know. In my country, anyway. I mean, maybe not in California, where YouTube was making their judgments, but...
Wow. Okay. That's wild.
I know.
I'm still on YouTube. I just put anything that's, like, too controversial on Rumble.
That's very wise. Very wise.
It's like, I'm not going to fight that monster. Oh, you did?
Yeah, I just started my little Rumble channel. It's only got, like, 3,000 subscribers or whatever, but, like, it's just nice to be able to, because what I used to do with my YouTube channel, after we started Lotus Eaters, like, I used to just sit in front of my camera and just do a stream and just talk for an hour, you know, just to be in contact with the people who are subscribing to me. But YouTube is just such a belligerent platform. I don't want to do it. Whereas Rumble is such a welcoming platform. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll use you, you know, because you seem to be invested in me as a content creator. Why would I give my labor to a platform that actually seems to kind of hate me and all my friends as well? Like, you know, literally everyone I'm friends with on the internet, YouTube's like, oh, that's a bad person. Demonetized, or you get the gold icon, or get shadow banned. And it's just like, can't we just have our thoughts, you know?
Oh, I don't know if you know about this. So my mom just got a strike on her channel. She's got a small channel. She has a podcast. Right. She's like 50,000 subscribers. She had this, like, 90-year-old Holocaust survivor on. And the Holocaust survivor said COVID was a fraud, you know, and so that was up on YouTube, and she got a strike on her channel, and they mandated social media training. So it wasn't just a strike and you remove the video. She has to do some sort of training. I've never heard of that.
It's a new thing that YouTube have brought in. I'm actually super careful about getting strikes. So, you know, in the office, as a team, we keep very careful track of what the YouTube guidelines are, because people don't realize YouTube has editorial guidelines. Like, as I understand it, the law in the United States that prevents YouTube from being sued by people instead of the person who uploads something, say, defamatory or libelous, is because they say, well, we're just a platform, we're just here to host content, and therefore the person who puts the content up is the person responsible for the editorial decision, and therefore they're the ones you sue. We get out scot-free. And that's, I can't remember, is it like Section 280 or something, I can't remember what it's called, right? But YouTube now has editorial policies. So it's like, okay, well, could someone please take that to court? So the court's like, no, you make editorial decisions on a whole manner of things. You can sue YouTube. And then I tell you what, they will stop with their editorial guidelines very, very quickly when it becomes apparent that actually people can sue YouTube because they're not adhering to the standard that allows them to act without being sued. So, I mean, I think that would go very far in an American court. I'm not an expert, but like, it seems like a fruitful thing for, because I know there's sort of like YouTube lawyers, there's a culture of YouTube lawyers. I don't know why none of them are sort of like, hey, why don't we push that? You know, like, when we see that, where that goes, you know, because they don't have to pay for a lawyer, you know? So.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so you're just careful with YouTube strikes. That seems like a good idea. I told my mom that too. I was like, don't fight it. You can't fight it. You can't really write something and they're going to change their guidelines. It's just, you have to be careful about what content you put on YouTube. You have to play the system. Yeah,
living unfortunately. Under an absolute tyranny when it comes to YouTube. You've got no right of appeal. You know, if they give you an appeal, you're very lucky. And if they deny it, there's nothing you can do about it. There's no arbiter. You're just under the tyranny. So you've just got to be smart and just accept, okay, these are the rules. I'll have to play by them.
Yeah, agreed. Unfortunately. Because I guess people are told, you know, fight back against other things. But YouTube's kind of this giant behemoth that maybe something else will pop along in the future. But it's pretty big.
And there's nothing you can do either, really. You know, you've got no leverage over YouTube. So it's very frustrating.
So you said, well, I suppose, okay, so identifying as a traditionalist, I don't know if you would use the words identify as a traditionalist or not, but that doesn't count as an ideology?
No, because I don't have a pre-formatted image of what the world should look like. I can't tell you what, you know, there isn't just a list of things that we can do to create the perfect traditional society. A tradition isn't something that any one person's got control over. It's the combined result of the actions of many people over a great deal of time, all working independently of each other, but in the same direction. And so traditions are kind of like a civilizational trial and error. And they build up their own ways of doing things, and they build up their own character that's based on the sort of people who are doing it. So, for example, I mean, a great example in Britain is the coronation of the king or the queen. You recognize that as being obviously British, but lots of other countries have kings and queens and have coronation ceremonies. It's just that they're different in character to our one, even though they are kind of in the same mold. But if you had an ideology, it could be that they could all be exactly the same, you know? So these are products of kind of, they're almost organic, you know what I mean? Like this sort of thing that grows and changes like a tree. And that's kind of what a tradition's like. It's kind of like a river, maybe.
I like that. How did you manage to switch your views from more liberal to being more open? Like, how did you, did you like grieve that process? Like, was there because I've had some of my belief systems change when I started recognizing that what I believed was a total lie. And I feel like it really turned my life upside down, right? I didn't know what to believe. I was like, is anything true? Is anything I believed true? What else am I believing that's a lie? I don't want to believe anything that's a lie. Like, did you have that kind of switch?
It wasn't overnight. It was a gradual process, but it was more about being humble in the scope of what I believed. Because the problem with ideology is because it's abstract, it becomes universal. And so you say, well, every person should live like this because I think that's good. And maybe for you, that would be good. And maybe for a small number of people, or maybe even a town or a city or even a country, that might be good. But you can't help but expand it to all mankind because it begins on you personally. And in the sort of liberal framework that most ideologies reside, like libertarianism is a form of liberalism, socialism is an outgrowth of liberalism. You know, they rest on the same philosophical foundations. And so you can't help but believe your constituency is all mankind. And that gives you a really big and broad and insane conception of the world, right? That's kind of mad. I'm in my head, I'm legislating for all humanity, not just now, but all through the past and all into the future for all of time. My idea is like the idea. It's like, that's wild, man. Like, I don't know. Like, you know, I'm still struggling with what time my kids are going to go to bed, really, you know? So, like, it was about being a bit more humble with the scope of what I thought was right and wrong, and locating it to my own country, which at least I have direct experience of, and I can look at the things we do, even if they're a bit irrational and a bit kooky, as, you know, British politics. I mean, like, why are we shouting at each other in the House of Commons? Because we've always shouted at each other in the House of Commons. It must have a function, even if I don't know what it is. And yeah, it's kind of embarrassing when a foreigner's like, oh my God, is that how you conduct politics? Like, yes, kind of. It is embarrassing. But it must work in some way. And so I'll accept it. And, you know, that's something we do. And it's a part of the wider tapestry. And this is another thing. Like, there are connections between things that you don't see. You don't even know are there until they're gone. And it's only at that point that it's too late to bring them back, to restore the thing that was doing something that you didn't realize it was doing. And this is the problem with ideology as well, is it highlights some linkages and makes invisible the rest. And so, you know, the shouting in the houses of parliament might have a real sort of calming effect on people politically or something like that. I don't know, you know, but it probably does something that I'm just not aware of. And so it's this kind of humbling of, okay, I don't have all the answers actually. And maybe taking smaller steps in a local position, like much like the sort of thing your dad advises actually. It's like, look, maybe if I just start with what's directly around me and make small changes incrementally over time, might be better than revolution, you know, might be better than trying to change everything for all humanity for all of time. And see, my life has got immeasurably better on a just immediate personal level, and for my family and, you know, my friends and my business, since I've had that kind of conscious understanding of this is the way forward. You know, it's definitely much better for the individual person, I think.
Well, I'm not going to be able to say I'm a libertarian after this podcast. Morally, so you've taken that.
If it helps, like, think of it,
I just don't know how to frame it. What's it called? I'm not sure.
So I have libertarian instincts, right? I don't like the state getting involved with stuff. I don't like people. I don't like the fact that I can't be armed, right? It really bothers me. Like, there's something on a genuine emotional level, I'm actually bothered that I can't really own a sidearm. You know, I could get a shotgun or a hunting rifle or something. But A, the state would be like, well, why do you want it? And I'd be like, I want to go duck hunting. I want to go pigeon shooting. You're not allowed it for home defense. And I'm like, I want to have a gun on my hip so I can shoot someone who attacks me, actually. That's why I want the gun. You know, but I can't say that. You know, now I've said it on the podcast, I'll probably never get a license for a gun. But having these sort of instincts is totally fine. And from the sort of left-wing position, like, I want to help people. You know, that's the socialist impulse, I think, genuinely comes from a position of a desire to help humanity and the people around them, right? It's just they don't really know how to do it. And so they've got, and the socialists come prepackaged with a whole ream of ideology that tells them, look, believe these things, advocate this, you're a good person and you're going to win. And that's seductive. It's hard not to be taken along by that, you know? And so I think rather than being committed to the ideology, it's worth thinking of yourself as just being inclined, having the moral sentiment towards the thing that underpins the ideology, whether it's freedom, whether it's cooperation, whether it's care for others. And that's, you know, that's at least you not relinquishing the sort of core of yourself, but also managing to sort of get the sludge of the ideology off yourself. And because that was the thing, coming out of liberalism really felt like I was coming out of like the Matrix. Like, you know, he's in the slime and he's just like, pulls the thing out of his mouth. He's like, where the hell am I? I kind of felt like that when I was coming out of liberalism. I think that's just what ideology is like. It covers you in a sludge and you need to kind of just scrape it off and be like, right, okay, I feel genuinely quite wholesome and decent. Let's begin from here, you know?
That I like that. That's kind of how I felt.
Yeah.
It's like, get it off. I was so angry too when some of my belief systems fell apart. I was just like, how could I have been so stupid?
Yeah.
Like I was lied to, and that's why I believed these things, but how could I have just believed these things? And for me, it started with the healthcare system in Canada thinking, and I was quite ill and trusted the healthcare system and doctors and things. And then when that fell apart, it's just everything fell apart. It was like, well, what other figure of authority is telling me that they're there for my benefit and I trust them when I shouldn't. And so that makes you, like, you get hit a couple of times with those belief systems falling apart, and hopefully it makes you humble about not knowing what else you have wrong.
Yeah, it's quite mad, isn't it? But yeah. I can't get over the Canadian healthcare system. Like,
oh, and you should hear Canadians talk about it. They're like, we've got the best healthcare system in the world. It's free. Like, there's a reason it's free.
Yeah, well, you should hear people talk about the NHS. The NHS is our god. England isn't a country with a health service. The health service is the health service with a country. We live to serve the NHS. If without the NHS, everyone in England dies, you see. And we praise and worship the NHS like literally like some sort of totemic idol where we have to make sacrifices to it. And it's mental. It's just mental. And, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I like having a public healthcare option. I like the fact that
option.
It's there.
Yeah.
But I don't want to worship it as a god, actually. weirdly enough. But I can't stand the maid thing in your country, though, man.
Ooh, just... I did an opposing views podcast. So I had one person who was pro-maid on and one person who was anti-maid. He was from America. But the pro-maid woman it was a doctor who spends her time, killing people is what she's doing. It was really quite disturbing. It's bad.
Oh, and, go on. Tell me a bit.
Well, she was just as creepy as you thought somebody would be. She was like caricature. She was a caricature of who I hope to get on to talk about maid. But it's really, you know, under the guise of compassion, And I was asking questions like, well, what happens if people are young and mentally ill? And now you can still apply for MAID when you're young and mentally ill in Canada. It was like, well, you can get very suicidal and very depressed and not have that be your entire life.
Yeah.
Right. It's just, and that, like, I struggled with a quite severe depression and pain from surgeries and things and not being able to get healthcare fast enough because good old Canada. And there were points where I was suicidal and there were points when, well, it's just having that as an option is so dangerous for people who already feel like they're a burden on society and they're a burden on their family and they don't know if they're going to get better. It's just, I can't believe that's happening under the guise of compassion. It's so dystopian. It's so disturbing.
And it's like 10,000 people a year as well, isn't it?
Yeah, for now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like sixth. I saw a stat. It was the sixth biggest killer in Canada is the government. And I don't want to get all libertarian about it, but that feels a bit wrong. I've seen some like accounts where, you know, people who are just mildly inconvenienced by something get a letter through and say, have you considered killing yourself?
Yes.
No, I haven't. You know, I wanted, like, there was this one woman who wanted a stairlift installed.
Yeah, my mom interviewed her.
Oh, really? That was right. Yeah. And it was just like, have you considered just shooting? Like, no, you monsters. Like, it's mad. It's absolutely mad.
Yeah, it's mad. Have you considered killing yourself? I just want a stair lift. The stairs are really hard for me.
Yeah, oh. I'm just feeling a bit down today, you know. Could I get some prescriptions to make myself feel a little better? No, but we could euthanize you. Great.
Yeah.
And the thing is as well, one thing that really bothers me about this is the way that we look at this through the eyes of the individual alone. Because I mean, I can concede that there could be some circumstances where someone has got like terminal cancer and they're in unbelievable pain all the time. And it's like, look, we can, because I mean, this happened to my nan when she passed away over COVID. She didn't pass away from COVID. She had cancer. And so she was basically just morphined up for like the last week or two of her life. And I saw her before she went, but she was just unconscious and in pain. She was, you know, just unconscious and groaning. And it was just like, okay, this is terrible. Yeah, and so it, like, you know, in a circumstance like that, okay, yeah, I can totally see the validity of a 91-year-old woman being spared that kind of suffering, right? But there's a difference between that and someone who's 27 and depressed, and because they've just, you know, they've had a series of just reverses in their life. You know, they broke up their boyfriend, they lost their job. Oh, they're getting kicked out of their apartment. Okay, I may as well just go into the suicide booth and euthanize myself. Like, and there's, it's awful. And the thing that really bothers me is, like, people aren't just alone. People aren't just individuals, right? You're connected. Everyone is born into a web of relationships with their brothers, their sisters, their mothers, their cousins, their aunts, their fathers, their uncles, their grandparents, their neighbors, their friends, you know, like friends to be in the future, you know, like all of these things all exist in you and are connected to you with like these sort of, you know, have you ever seen the film Donnie Darko, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
many times.
The weird beam thing that comes out of his chest? That's how I kind of view what a relationship is these days. So it connects two people. It's this weird beam. And if the more you love that person, the thicker and brighter that beam is, and the more it withers away, right? And if you think of like a person as being situated in reality with these things connecting to everyone they know in some degree, and then they've got one on everyone else they know, and there's suddenly you see there's this great shining web that connects everyone. And it's like someone killing themselves ruins the connection that they have with everyone. It destroys it. And it's this real sharp pain that everyone feels. Like, my uncle committed suicide a few years ago. And man, my cousins have not been the same since. It's been unbelievably painful for them. It breaks my heart, you know. And it's just, you don't realize the damage you do when you do that. You know, you're not the only person who matters here, actually. And but again, it's a kind of consequence of the spell of liberalism. It's like, well, it's your choice. It's you. It's like, okay, you're feeling a bit mopey, but your mum is going to feel so much worse for what, you know, for you. And it's so short-sighted. In the near future, things will get better. Like, it's not going to be like this forever, you know?
Yeah. No, a horrible thing about mental illness, too, is when you're in it, it feels like it's going to be there forever. It really does. And you shouldn't have, I don't think you should have that option. And it's funny because, so the guy I talked to who was based in the U.S., he said, well, there are states that have had, you know, gentle ways of dying, so like assisted death, for decades and decades, but it's set for these people that are like you described. Yeah. They're really old and really sick, and it's just like, come on, they don't need to suffer this out. Like, we already know what's going to happen in the end. But no one talked about it because that was okay. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
But no, that's
Canada. Canada's screwed, though, I think, for a while.
Yeah, I think so too. I've got a bunch of Canadian friends, and they all say the same. There's exactly what you're saying. You know, it's just like all of the problems. But this the thing I was thinking there, what you just said, like they already do this for the old folks who are very old and suffering and dying, but no one cares. No one talks about it. Why not? And I think it's genuinely something to do with the fact that people live their lives as stories, right? That your life is your story, and you think of it as your story, and every story has acts. And of course, when you're like 80 years old, you're in the final act of your story, and there's only one conclusion to the final act of the story, and that's for you to pass on. And so it's normal and natural for that to happen, you know. And so no one's surprised by it. There's nothing offensive about it. It's inevitable, actually. And you know, I'm not saying we should look forward to it, but like, we shouldn't, like, I'm not bothered about growing old. Like, it's really weird. Like, I'm 44, and I'm actually happier now than I've ever been in my life. And I don't see myself getting less happy, you know, and I'm not bothered by my age. I'm not bothered by going gray. Like, I'm actually kind of enjoying it. You know, it gives you, I've arrived in a different stage of life. Where actually I feel like I've got a lot of stuff figured out, actually. And I can see the young people around me who don't have these things figured out. And I can see them making the same mistakes I made. And I can actually give them some pertinent advice. And so, like, it's not bad to move into the new phases of your story. And for some reason, and again, it's liberalism that is the spell here, because it thinks of us as kind of self-created humans that have always existed and always exist at year zero. It's like, no, actually, we're a long tail. And the longer the story goes on for, the more rich it becomes and the more worthwhile it is hearing for other people, you know? And so it's just a totally different way of seeing ourselves, our civilization, our own lives, you know, the purpose we have with the people around us. But it's just, I just feel so much better, man. And I'm not like on social justice crusades to try and eliminate, you know, hardship or anything. I'm just watching everyone around me do well. And it's good to be a part of it. Okay?
That's so nice. That would be nice for people to hear. I think the same thing. I like the younger I was, the harder life was. And that was partly from being ill, but it was also partly from, I'm not sure. Although what I can say is the 30s is significantly better than the 20s, which isn't something I thought I would say. Yeah.
It's totally true because you don't know anything. You know, you're just inexperienced in your 20s. And I mean, I remember my 20s and I like had no idea what I was doing at all. I was totally unmoored.
Like, did you think you did?
I didn't think about it. You know, I just like bumbled through each day, not really thinking very hard about the future. And we were never encouraged to think about the future. You know, there was nothing around me that was telling me, by the way, have you been planning for like 10 years time, 20 years time? And so by the time I was in my mid 30s, I hadn't achieved anything really. I didn't even think about it. And then I started like a YouTube channel because I was pissed off with a few things. And suddenly I, you know, 10 years later, I've got this massive YouTube channel and I've got business and stuff like that. But so I like kind of lucked into being successful. But had that not happened, I don't even know how I would have become successful. I may well have not, you know? And so I really wish I'd been better advised when I was young to think and have a more long-term view of my own story, you know, where, you know, to view it as, like, you know, you need to take certain steps now to arrive at a certain place then. So actually crack on, you know, trust me, you know, you will think it's worth it, you know?
I think I'm really fortunate to have had my dad as my dad because long-term planning was built. Like, I don't even remember. I remember planning long-term when I was in like grade two.
Really?
Like it was just built in. Yeah. So I always had a 10-year plan. Now, unfortunately, like things would change and then that plan would be completely fall apart, which kind of hurt. But I was I always had a long-term plan. And so I never had that. And I didn't realize how rare that was. So,
yeah, I mean, my dad's like a very conservative guy. And so he was always like, you know, you need to think ahead, son. You know, you need to think of this, you need to think of that, you need to work hard. But the culture I was submersed in, the sort of, you know, pop culture of the sort of 90s and early 2000s, the messaging was the total reverse. You know, it's literally, don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. You're in the end of history, basically, is what they were saying. You can just relax and be a wastrel. You know, that was essentially the message that was coming across. And so thinking about it now, my dad's good advice was always totally drowned out by this cultural messaging. And I've always been a pretty self-confident person with my ability to handle whatever's in front of me. And so I didn't really listen to him, you know? And so by the time I got into my early 30s, I was like, oh my God, why don't I have the things I expected to have? You know, and maybe in your case it's different sort of thing, but like, I think for most people, I think this cultural, you know, fluid that we exist and swim through is really powerful on a subconscious level. I don't think people really think about it, but if we had more wholesome and positive messaging rather than the messaging we get out of TV and the music we listen to, and if you think about it, like, just take a second to be even vaguely critical of the music, the lyrics to any music you listen to, or the general message of any film that you watch, and think, is that what I teach my kids? You know, would I want my kids thinking that? And you realize actually the entire culture is kind of like debauched, you know, like there's kind of like gross and immediate, and it's not very conducive to creating a better world tomorrow. And I think about this a lot, because it's just like, what must other people think of us, right? Because I mean, I know that like a lot of the criticisms of quite hardline Islamists are that we're a disgusting, perverse culture, and I'm like, well, kind of. And here's Cardi B's WAP, you know, and it's just like, yeah, that's kind of true. Not my, you know, I don't like their religion. I don't respect them as people. I don't want to do what they want to do. But some of their critiques do cut a bit close to home, right? So.
Mm-hmm. That's how I kind of felt in Eastern Europe too, with Russian critiques of America. It's like, well, look at what you're doing to your kids in school. Yep. Not sure what I can say about that.
Yeah, I can't. You got us there, to be honest, you know.
Yeah. Well, that was very interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. That was fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Sorry, it felt a little more serious than I thought it was going to be, actually. Like, I felt, you know, I've seen a few speeches. Not this heavy tonally, normally. And so I thought we'd just end up having quite a fun conversation. But then you sort of, like, open with questions that I, like, have been thinking about and couldn't help but kind of just, you know, big brain dump. Okay, well, here are my thoughts on it. And, you know, I think they're quite existential and we need to think about them, you know? So I hope it wasn't too much or anything, you know?
No, not at all. That was way better. That was good. I guess I wanted to go deep. That was fun. So thank you.
That was great.
Thank you very much for coming on.
It's my pleasure, honestly. I really appreciate the invite. It's really good.